Thanks very much. Thanks to all of you for coming out. I figured that I'm competing with a 4th of July picnic and that no one would show because it would be unpatriotic. But thanks very much for coming. Wherever the sound guy is, could we just turn down the volume a little bit? And if possible, just a little bit. And if you have a treble control, to give us some more high end. I'm in a rock band, and I'm a bit of a fanatic about sound. Okay, we need a little more sound. Thank you. Or you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to use the handheld mic. Check. That's a lot better. Is that better? Okay. Feel like Bob Barker on The Price is Right. Come on down. Okay. In the next half an hour, I'd like to try and convince you that the corporation, as we've known it, is going through the biggest change in a century, and that this change is being brought about by the rise of the new web, or the so-called Web 2.0. And the companies that are figuring this out are companies that are tending to be successful, and those that don't are tending to be the ones that fall behind. So the stakes are very high. Let me begin by congratulating each of you personally for having been selected by Time Magazine as the Person of the Year. In fact, I think you should all give yourself a big round of applause, please. Very well done, all of you. It's true, social networking is exploding. I was at MySpace last week. MySpace has 2 million new members per week and has been tracking on that for a year. They have over 200 million members. 85% of all college students in the United States are on Facebook. There's a new blog created every second of the day, 24 hours a day, and Time selected you as the Person of the Year. Well, I'm here today to tell you that that is so 2006. Because what's happening now is that this is no longer about hooking up online, creating a gardening community, or posting a video onto YouTube. This is becoming a new mode of production. And it's beginning to fundamentally change the way that we innovate, the way that we create goods and services, the way that companies orchestrate capability to create value, and the ways that companies engage with the rest of the world. How so? Well, there are four big drivers that are causing all this to happen. The first is what's been referred to as the Web 2.0. This is not your big brother's internet or your daddy's internet. The internet is going through a fundamental change right now. The old web, you accessed it through a PC tethered to a desktop. It was low speed. It was about data and text with some graphics. And it was a platform for the presentation of information. The new web, first of all, is different in a number of ways. You access it not through a PC only, but through what I refer to as the thing. Billions, soon trillions, of inert objects that become smart communicating devices. So I have a friend in Toronto. Everything in his house that has electrical power has an IP address. That means it's connected to the internet. And all this stuff talks to itself. And I'm not sure what his microwave says to his refrigerator, but it's got something to do with how to cook a pork chop. He was bragging that his fence talks to his sprinkler system. And I said, well, why would you care? And he says, well, Don, if a burglar comes over the fence, the sprinkler is my first line of defense. So this is pervasive, ambient, broadband, ubiquitous, rich media computing. And the old web was about the presentation of information based on a standard called HTML. That's why during that period you heard everybody talk about websites and stickiness and clicks and eyeballs and page views, and you heard expressions like content is king. The new web is based on a standard called XML, and it's not a standard for presentation of content. It's a standard for computation. The web is becoming a giant global computer enriched with services. And you know, Thomas Watson was famously to have said that the world will only need 5 computers. Well, thinking about it, he was terribly wrong. He was off by 4. Because in a sense, we have a giant global computer now. And every time you go onto that computer and you upload a video onto YouTube, or as you did, as I did, I put a picture of my Bernese Mountain Dog puppy onto Flickr, they asked me to name the picture. In technical terms, they're asking for an XML tag. And I choose the following words to describe my Bernese Mountain Dog puppy. I choose the words Bernese Mountain Dog puppy. Turns out when you let people self-organize, they're pretty good at choosing their own XML tags. And all of a sudden, I'm into this place with 934 other Bernese Mountain Dog owners, and we're finding out why our puppies eat sticks and have diarrhea. And sorry, that's not a good lunchtime thing. But I am programming the internet when I do this. So this is becoming a giant global computational platform. Theme number two is this new web is intersecting with a new generation of young people who are growing up digital. And these kids are different. Who here has children or grandchildren under the age of 29? Hands, please. Okay. Those who put up your hands, which of those kids use a computer connected to the internet? Hands, please. Okay, same group put up their hands twice. We have the first generation to grow up digital, and these kids are different. I started studying these kids about 12 years ago when I noticed how my own children were effortlessly able to use all this sophisticated technology. And at first I thought, my children are prodigies. And then I noticed that all their friends were like them, and the theory that all their friends were prodigies was a bit of a stretch. So I started looking at them as a generation. I worked with these 300 kids for a period of a year, and I wrote this book. I came to the conclusion that they have no fear of technology because it's like the air. It's not there. When your daughter's online chatting with her friends, she's not thinking, whoa, I really love this synchronous, real-time, text-based communication mode. She's thinking what her friend said. When your son downloads an MP3 file, he's not thinking, whoa, MP3 compression formats are a real disruptive technology that are leading to peer-to-peer file sharing or something. He's thinking, great, I just got the song that I wanted. So, furthermore, time online is not taken away from hanging out with your friends, learning the piano, talking to your parents, or doing your homework. Time online is fundamentally taken away from television. The boomers watch 24, their parents, you people, watch 24 hours a week of TV. And these kids watch less TV and they watch it differently. They come home and they turn on their computer. And they're in four different windows. They're listening to MP3 files, talking on the phone with a video game going on the side. They got three magazines open. They're doing their homework. And yes, the television's going on in the background. But what's happening is that rather than being the passive recipients of somebody else's broadcast video, what are they doing? Yeah, they're interacting. They're reading. They're thinking. They're organizing information. They're searching, authenticating, composing their thoughts, telling their stories. This is creating a generation who actually processes information differently. Their brains are wired differently. And furthermore, this is the first time in human history when children are an authority about something really important. I was an authority on model trains when I was a kid. Your kids are authorities on this big revolution that's changing every institution in society. You know, the 60s, we had a generation gap, big differences between kids and parents over values, lifestyle, ideology. It doesn't exist so much today. Kids and parents get along pretty well. Look at music. What's on your iPod and your kid's iPod? There's an overlap. My parents didn't even like the Beatles. What we've got today is a generation lap, where kids are lapping their parents on the info track. So this was one of many humbling experiences that's happened to me. I interviewed these four youngsters in front of a couple of thousand people at a big congress last year, out of the mouths of babes, over 100 sessions at this congress. And this was the highest rated by far. It got an emotional standing ovation. This is Rahaf Harfouch, a 20-year-old Syrian studying at the Sorbonne in Paris. Her boyfriend is in Toronto. To keep their relationship going, they turn on video Skype all day long. They cook together, work together. She likes Desperate Housewives. She can't get that show in Paris. He turns the webcam on the TV in Toronto. I asked her, do you kids use email? And she said, email? Not really. That's kind of like yesterday's technology. And I said, well, what do you use? She said, well, we use Skype and instant messaging, and we use Facebook. Everybody's on Facebook. That's how we communicate. I said to her, well, what would you use email for? She said, it's kind of like a, I don't know, formal technology, say for sending a thank you letter to one of your friend's parents. That would be a good use of email, I guess. This is Allison Featherstonehaw, 15-year-old daughter of Brian Featherstonehaw. She gets $25 a month for tracking how she and her friends interact with media around the world. Her dad pays her this because her dad, Brian, is the CEO of Ogilvy One, and he noticed when she's watching TV, she's time-shifting and bleeping out all the advertisements. And if you're a ad guy, that's like the scariest thing you've ever seen. This is a young woman who lives in New Zealand. She has 80 students who are teaching the teachers of New Zealand how to use the internet in the classroom. I asked her, what are the teachers like as students? She says, I have to tell you, they're awful. They don't do their homework. They talk in class. I said, you ever give out a pink slip? She said, just two last week. And this is Michael Furtick, the granddaddy of them all. He's 24 years old. I've known Michael since he was 12, when he was the project manager on my website, growingupdigital.com. They made him the project manager as a 12-year-old because he was the oldest and most experienced engineer on the team. When Michael was 16, he had his own site getting 20 million page views per month, and he sold it for an undisclosed seven- or eight-figure sum. One of the news reports said it was only $1 million, and I wrote him an email. I said, Michael, you sold it for $1 million. You should have called me. And he wrote back, and he said, Don, legally, I can't tell you how much I sold it for, but I can tell you I'm very happy. And he didn't want the money to buy a Ferrari, although he bought a cheap little car, but his mom had to drive around with him because he only had his learner's permit. He wanted the money to invest in his next new venture. It's called takingitglobal.org. One word, taking it global. 140,000 young people active on a daily basis in 70 countries. And this is a social network for kids who want to change the world. One of their modest objectives is that every kid on planet Earth age 4 should have access to the internet. So this is a generation that's very different. I'm right now doing a $4 million research project on this generation. We're interviewing 11,000 of them, and we're looking at how are they changing the world as they come into the workforce, into the marketplace, and as they become citizens. They're different. They want freedom. Freedom of choice. Choice is like oxygen. When I was a kid, I had three media choices. These kids have thousands of choices. They want freedom of mobility in the workforce. By the time they're 27, they're on their third job. I hired a guy a year ago. His name's Dennis Hancock. He's 29. It's the fourth time I've hired him. And he just went back to school. He's doing his MBA in the fall. I'm not retaining human capital like, I don't know, you retain fluids or something. I'm sort of building an alumni network. That's the way I view it. They want to customize everything. I never got to customize the Mickey Mouse Club as I was a kid. These kids can change their world. Industry after industry doesn't understand this. The auto industry missed an $8 billion market called the tuner market, where kids want to change their cars. The number two TV show for teenage boys is Pimp My Ride. They're the scrutinizers. When I saw a picture, it was a picture as a kid. These kids see a picture. What is it, an animation, a bot, a morph? You know, it's a woman on a magazine. How's she been photoshopped? Oh, her cheekbones are bigger and her femur's longer. I'm 12-year-old Moose Lips and I'm chatting with 13-year-old Cyber Chick. I have to authenticate. Is it really Cyber Chick I'm talking to all the time? Maybe it's Cyber Chick's younger brother's sort of trying to have some fun, or Cyber Chick's dad who's trying to find out what's going on with the teenagers, or cyber evil person who might harm me. So they're kids who have got amazing BS detectors as a generation. It's not true what you read in the newspaper that they don't give a damn. You know, they're not informed, they don't read the papers, they get their news from The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. What else do you hear? They're the me generation. They're the shoppers. All they care about is their video games and their internet connections. They're not voting so much. None of this is supported by the data. This is a generation with very strong values, a strong sense of integrity, and they don't get their news from The Daily Show because The Daily Show isn't funny unless you know the news. It's the most informed generation ever. Test rates, by the way, have gone up year over year for 10 years. Teen pregnancy has gone down year over year for 10 years. Youth crime has gone down year over year for 10 years. This is the collaboration and relationship generation. As much as I thought I had a relationship with Annette Funicello on the Mickey Mouse Club, it wasn't so. My daughter has 350 friends on Facebook. These are all people she knows, and she's 24. And with their friends, there's 11,000. And Jared, who's a relationship marketer at Yub.com, gets to 11 million. He's 19 years old. When I was 19, I influenced 6 or 7 people. He influences 11 million. Entertainment and fun is part of everything. We ask the kids, when you're online, are you working? Are you learning? Are you collaborating? Or are you having fun? And they all answer the question the same way. They say, I can't answer the question. Those are all the same thing to me. When I was watching Mickey Mouse, I was only doing one thing. I was having fun. So a generation that comes into the workforce and the marketplace, fun is part of everything. I was doing a briefing for a Fortune 20 company, and they had the top a couple hundred people there for a whole day. We did a session on this topic, the net generation. They brought in a couple of young people, and they asked them, what could we do to make this place more attractive for your generation so that your generation would want to work at our company? This young woman gets up. She's 23, just out of school. Without missing a beat, she says, I think this place should be more fun. All these guys are like, what is she talking about? Fun, you know? Work is work, and fun is fun. There's a period in your day where you work, and then you go home, and you, I don't know, have a martini, and that's fun. But these are not the same activity. They're the speed generation. The metabolism of everything is sped up. It doesn't mean they're impatient, but they want things to happen quickly, and they want innovation in everything. So there are 80 million of them coming into the workforce and the marketplace in the United States. 78 million baby boomers. This is the biggest generation ever. These kids are different, and they're a huge force for change. Theme number 3 is, you put those two together, you get a social revolution. Now, I could show you 30 charts, and they all look the same. They all show the old HTML website that thinks that content is king, and the information is about the presentation of information, being replaced by the XML-based community that thinks that content collaboration is what counts and community is what counts. So web shots used to be the place to put pictures on the internet, and now it's been replaced by Flickr. And Dig is actually now being replaced by Slashdot. These are largely technical communities. Craigslist is the place to find a job on the internet, not Monster or Match. MySpace is killing MTV as a platform for music. See, MTV says, no, we're a content provider. We put music out onto the net. And MySpace says, no, we're a context creator. And if you're a musician, come and put your music on the web. There are 40,000 bands that are now on MySpace, including my band. It's called Men in Suits. Wikipedia's beating, oh, this is hardly fair. For those of you at the back of the room, there's a little red line along the bottom here. We'll come to that later. Blogger is beating CNN.com. Opinions is beating Consumer Reports. So what's going on? Well, tell a story. For those of you who were in the previous session, I apologize. I told this story, but it was on Christmas Day, and I gave an advanced copy of Wikinomics to my son, Alex, 20 years old. He's a junior. And he said, thanks, Dad. He went off, started reading, came back a couple hours later, said, hey, Dad, this is a good book. You know, you surprised, Alex. Anyway, he says, I think I'm going to create a community on Facebook. I said, you mind if I watch? 15 minutes later, he's created the Wikinomicist community on Facebook. Another 15 minutes later, he has 6 members, and he sent out a PDF of the first 2 chapters of the book. By the time we're eating turkey on Christmas Day, He's got 130 members in 7 countries, a president, secretary, chief information officer for the community. He's got 7 regional coordinators. I got kids writing in saying, Mr. Tapscott, we found errors in the first 2 chapters of your book, and the community is placing demands on me. So how exactly will Mr. Tapscott be contributing to our community? Bob Dylan, there's something going on here and you don't know what it is. Self-organization has been around throughout human history. Language was developed through self-organization. There was no central committee that said this will be called a spoon. It just kind of happened. But now, what used to take place over millennia can happen overnight or on Christmas Day. And that sets us up for the big one that I'm here to try and explain to you. There's an economic revolution that's underway as well. You know, it's tempting to say that, well, maybe this is a big bubble. It's another bubble all over again. You know something? It's a British economist named Carlotta Perez, and she studied great innovations throughout history. Steam engine, internal combustion, telephone, electricity, radio, TV, whatever. They all have a similar path. You get invention, experimentation, investment, excitement. You get speculation, and you always get a bubble, and then the bubble bursts. And then you get cynicism. And then you move into a period of decades of long-term deployment where the real impact of the technology becomes understood on business models and on the economy. Well, that's what's happening here today. Exhibit A, a new species of business called the digital conglomerate. That's what I call them. What is Google? Well, it's a search engine, right? They say they're an internet company or a technology company. They're really an ad agency. They're in the advertising business because that's how they make their money, is selling ads. But they're also a media company, and they bought YouTube, and they'd like to be the platform for all television and all media. But they're also a wireless company providing high-speed wireless in San Francisco and soon throughout the world. And if you want to see an interesting conversation, type in my name onto YouTube, and the first thing you'll get is a 1-hour conversation between me and Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google, where he basically admits that they're a digital conglomerate and telephony is just an application on a wireless network. So you can conclude from that maybe that Google will be a telephone company. Google is a retail company because they sell things. And once you're a retail company, you need a payment system. So eBay has PayPal. Google has GBuy. Once you have a payment system, you enter into the financial services industry. They say, but, well, we're not a software company. And every week they release new web services targeted at the heart of Microsoft. And Eric Schmidt was asked, do you compete with Microsoft? And he said, I don't know. I'm not Microsoft. They are now the 4th largest maker of hardware, computer hardware, servers in the United States. They have one customer, themselves. Football field size data farms that are eating up a big chunk of the power grid of California. Forget about ISO 9000. These things are held together with duct tape. And one doesn't work, you yank it out and you stick another one in. We've never seen anything like this before. It's a new species of business. We are now moving into decades of long-term deployment where the real impact of this technology becomes understood. So what's happening here? 4 very disruptive themes about how you think about innovating and creating value. The first is peering. 70 years ago, there was a Nobel Prize-winning economist named Ronald Coase, C-O-A-S-E, and he asked a deceptively simple question in a paper. He said, why does the firm exist? He said, if Adam Smith is right and the open market's the best mechanism to determine how goods and resources and information and materials are allocated in an economy, why isn't everybody an independent contractor at every step along the way in production? Why do we all work for these big vertically integrated firms that do everything from soup to nuts? And the answer is, he said, and he won a Nobel Prize for saying this, the answer is transaction costs. And the way he defined it, he meant collaboration costs, the cost of coordination, the cost of search in an open market, trying to find all the right people and information and resources to do something totally prohibitive. Search, said this 70 years ago. The cost of contracting. So the big industrialists understood this. Henry Ford, within the boundaries of the Ford Motor Company, had a power plant, a steel mill, a shipping company, a glass factory. Why? Because the costs of collaboration in an open market were greater than the cost of doing things inside the boundaries of the corporation. Now, it was a couple of decades ago, I wrote a book some of you may have read called Paradigm Shift. And I said, well, just a second. I think the boundaries of this corporation are becoming more porous because of technology and networks. And back then, I called it the extended enterprise. Then we saw the rise of the internet, and collaboration costs dropped further, so that we had business webs where companies focused on what they did best and they partnered. So Cisco understood this and built a business web as opposed to a vertically integrated company. It succeeded and its competitors did not. And now we're moving to the really big one, where collaboration costs in the global economy are dropping so much that peers outside the boundaries of traditional companies can now come together and create value. So if you can create an encyclopedia that's 10 times bigger than Britannica, it's real time, it's in dozens of languages, nobody owns it, and it's created by a million people, but according to the big study that was done, the quality is just as good as Britannica, the one developed by the Nobel Prize winners. Well, what else could you create? Could you create an operating system for computers called Linux? It's the dominant operating system for medium and large computers. Nobody owns it. It's a product of mass collaboration. Could you create a mutual fund? It's called marketocracy. Could you create a physical good like a motorcycle? Well, you'll see in a second. That's theme number one. Theme number two is transparency is now a new force in the economy for trust and growth. Companies are being scrutinized like never before. So as corporations are becoming naked. And if you're going to be naked, well, fitness is no longer an option, okay? Or you better be buff, meaning you better have good values and you also need to have integrity baked into your bones. And if you are a buff company, you can open the kimono, not on everything, but you can share pertinent information with customers and business partners, employees, shareholders, the communities within which you operate. And in doing that, it turns out you build a more high-performance business model, you grow faster, and you compete better. This is very counterintuitive. It's sort of like undress for success. Thirdly, and this gets more counterintuitive, you kill your competition by sharing intellectual property. Now, how does that work? Well, you could argue, as some people have, that if you share intellectual property, for example, place it in the commons where everybody has access to it, that undermines the legitimate right of companies to make a profit. Didn't Linux hurt Microsoft? Didn't MP3 hurt the record companies? Didn't Wikipedia hurt Britannica? Isn't this communist, as some people who have called it that? Well, only if you're very superficial. You see, it turns out that if you have a portfolio of intellectual property, some that you own and some that you share, you can compete better. So IBM, rather than fighting Linux, embraced it. They save $1 billion a year in developing and maintaining a proprietary operating system, and they've created a platform called Linux upon which they've built a multi-billion-dollar business. And the final sort of jarring theme that doesn't feel right is if you Google the expression think global, act local, you get millions of hits. If you Google the expression think global, act global, you get a bunch of mistakes of people who didn't get the expression right. I find that kind of curious. If we truly do have a global economy, and Thomas Friedman in The World is Flat, if he's right, then why do we have a bunch of multinationals as opposed to truly global corporations? Well, we had national corporations and nation states, and they went to another nation state, and they became a multinational corporation. But increasingly, we need to have companies that have global business processes, global information technology, global standards. One of the big car companies acted global when it came to business ethics. They had a $70 million fund for bribing people in countries where locally that was okay to do it. Well, you're going to be held to the highest standard. You need to act globally. Furthermore, I don't think the world is flat. I think it's very, as Richard Florida says, very spiky. And the engine of the global economy is changing to Asia. Any of you have been to Shanghai know what I'm talking about. 1985, Shanghai had one skyscraper. Today, it has 320. Half of the cranes in the world are in Shanghai. China is about to become the largest auto market in the world, but it's very uneven. It's also the place you're most likely to be killed in a car, and there's 500 million people have never used a toothbrush. So India, Asian juggernauts, ICICI Bank, so on, coming out. So increasingly, of course, you need to be sensitive to local specificities, but increasingly we're going to see truly global corporations. Now, I know this is generating a lot of questions, and I'll try and wrap this up so that we can get to it. So four big drivers, then, are coming together, and they're kind of creating your first Category 6 business revolution, a very profound change in the architecture and the modus operandi of a corporation. So let me just tell you a story on this to make the point. It's a gold mining company. It's based in Toronto, and a guy named Rob McEwen, I know this guy because he's my neighbor, took over the company. He's a banker, and he took it over, became the CEO and its principal shareholder. And he was a very frustrated person because his geologists couldn't tell him if he had any gold or where it was. And after years of being frustrated, he was ready to shut the company down. But he was also curious, and he wondered, if my geologists don't know where the gold is, my properties, maybe somebody else does. So he did a radical thing. He took his geological data, which in the mining industry is your biggest secret, your intellectual property, is kept in safes and high security computer systems. He shared it. He published his geological data and held a contest on the internet. $500,000 in prize money for anyone who can tell me, do I have any gold? And if so, where is it? He got submissions from all around the world, 77 of them. They used techniques that he'd never heard of, and for his $500,000 in prize money, found $3.4 billion worth of gold. The market value of his company went from $90 million to $10 billion, and I can tell you, because he's my neighbor, he's a happy camper. What's going on here? The four principles of Wickenomics. He peered. He didn't think, oh, I need a better head of geology, someone who can kick a button because the most precious human capital is inside the boundaries of our company. Your human capital goes out in the elevator every night. No, no. He said, maybe the uniquely qualified minds are peers of the people who work for me outside the boundaries of my company. You know, many of the submissions came from mathematicians, computer scientists, chemists. The winner was a computer graphics company that built a three-dimensional model of his mine. He could helicopter under the ground and find gold. He peered. Secondly, he was open. He was transparent. He stood up in front of the world and he said, I'm Rob McEwen. I'm the CEO of a gold mining company, and I don't know if we have any gold, but we're going to find out. Thirdly, and he built trust by doing that. Thirdly, he shared his intellectual property, unthinkable in the mining industry, and fourth, he acted global. He viewed the world as his geology department. So this is leading to a bunch of very disruptive new business models that are kind of shaking the windows and rattling the walls of corporations. And I don't have time to really go through these. So why don't I just fly through them and then we can have a quick conversation. Do you know that there's 150,000 open source application projects that are underway today? And you have companies like SpikeSource that are doing hundreds of thousands of tests on them every night to find out which of these software packages are ready for your company. Motley Fool or Marketocracy, mutual funds that outperform the market and they're chosen by the mob. The 100 best stock pickers on the internet decide what goes into the mutual fund. Could you create a peer-to-peer bank? You got some money? I need some money. What do we need a bank for if we have a trust syndication method? eBay is a method for syndicating trust, for selling physical goods, It's called the feedback form on eBay. Why couldn't we have a trust indication method for the exchange of money? This is, I don't have the full animation here. This is a three-dimensional animation of the Notre Dame in Paris that was created by someone who went onto the web to photo sites and took photographs of tourists of the Notre Dame and put together millions of photographs to create a total three-dimensional model of the Notre Dame. A second one is called Ideagoras. These are open markets for innovations. You know the Greek and Roman agora? These are agoras for ideas. So Procter & Gamble's looking for a molecule that'll take red wine off a shirt. You do the math. They have 9,000 chemists inside the boundaries of P&G and 1.5 million chemists outside the boundaries of P&G. Where is it more likely they'll find the molecule? Sure enough, there's a retired chemist in Taipei or a grad student who's now a ski instructor in Aspen, finds the model, that, or the molecule, they get paid $150,000. Well, how do you get your internal people to want to find it outside? What about the not invented syndrome, NIH? P&G, they call it the PFE syndrome, proudly found elsewhere. And half of all their innovations will come from outside the company by the end of this year. We're tracking about 60 of these, open markets, idea connection, and so on. Thirdly, prosumers. How do you turn your customers into producers of your product? Second Life is a company that does this. It's a virtual world where 99% of the product is built by you and me. This is a lecture that I gave in Second Life. You recognize some of the... This tall, thin, young guy with the spiky hair here, that would be me. I have to tell you how that happened. I don't have time to design my own avatar. So I said to a designer, it's a hotshot young woman, she's about 18. I said, look, I want my avatar to be male, really old, someone who looks like they've been there, done that, and I don't want to look like a hippie or something. Put me in a suit. She says, okay. I come back. I'm ready to give my lecture. She says, here's your avatar, and she presents this guy. It's like 30 years old or something. And I said, what's with this? I asked for a really old person. She said, yeah. Everything is relative, right? But the point is, when I built that avatar, I was creating the Second Life product. Now, the music industry is the poster child on how to do this wrong. A new distribution channel, a whole new model. They could have embraced it. They fought it. And so someone takes, because kids want to customize things, someone takes the Beatles' White Album, Jay-Z's Black Album, they remix them to create the Gray Album. Sales of the White Album go up, sales of the Black Album go up, and he gets sued by the record industry. Unbelievable. So Lego, on the other hand, has a product called Mindstorms. Kids build robots. But because kids know so much about technology, they hacked the code for these Mindstorm applications. They created a website and started sharing the code. So Lego had a choice. It could be like the music industry and decide to sue the children. Or it could open the whole thing up, which is what they did. There are now thousands of software engineers between the ages of 70 and 4 developing Mindstorm applications. They turn their consumers into producers. The final chapter of Wikinomics is a wiki. And it's very active. And my publisher, although it's a weird world, they completely changed everything, the whole structure. And my publisher came to me and said, darn, Wikinomics, huge book. We want to release another version for Christmas. Why don't we take all the best ideas from the wiki and we'll summarize them and create a new chapter for the actual book that will sell? And I said, I can't do that. The final chapter is done under a Creative Commons license. I don't own rights to this. And they said, well, why would you do something like that? And I said, hey, you're my publisher. You should read the book. You know? Basically, if I create, this is the final chapter, is the definitive guide to the 21st century corporation. If I create that, or if I'm the context creator for that, I figure this will benefit me somehow. You know, in my business, I don't fear theft of my ideas. I fear obscurity, basically. So you can now prosume physical goods like clothing. Fourth, science. Imagine if the biotech companies had decided to own a chunk of the human genome. how that would have set back humanity. They didn't. They put the human genome in the commons, and now a rising tide lifts all boats. And there are thousands of mass collaborations by scientists around the world today. Google, Nature's Google Earth avian flu mashup. So some nurse in Hong Kong spots the avian flu. The local hospital wants to keep it quiet. She puts it on to the mashup. Scientists are now tracking this disease. There are mass collaborations around AIDS. I think the biggest one, probably the biggest mass collaboration ever in human history, is around climate change, with thousands and thousands of communities now organized into a global movement to do something about this. And they involve scientists and NGOs and private companies and all kinds of people. Open platforms. This is an open computer that exists now on planet Earth. And so the authorities responded badly in Katrina, and people went to Google Maps, and they do a little thing. Woman in second floor of house in wheelchair, water 8 feet and rising, 2:22 p.m. Here's the address. People's lives were saved. So now companies are opening up their business infrastructures. Amazon has done this, and there are 200,000 programmers who don't work for Amazon who are creating capability on the Amazon platform. And if you're a little mom-and-pop business in Aspen, you can use Amazon for marketing, e-commerce, payment, distribution, logistics, and for $70 a month, you can rent a server. And if you need 1,000 servers one day, no problem. The Amazon cloud expands to fill the availability. This extends to the most complicated product I can think of, which is a new generation jumbo jet. Boeing says the old way is not going to work. The old way is you create a 30,000-page spec, because the best minds are inside the boundaries of your company, right? And then you give it out to your supply chain, hierarchies, and you beat them up. Boeing says to its suppliers, you're not suppliers, you're peers. You make important parts of this aircraft, like the engine, the fuselage, the electronics, the interior, the entertainment system. Here's a 20-page document. Let's co-innovate this aircraft. The orders are so strong for the 787 Dreamliner and the competitor Airbus that went the old way, some people say will never come to market. Mass collaboration may not be a better way of building the most complicated thing you can think of. It may be the only way. And where is this going? Well, buckle up. The Chinese motorcycle industry is hundreds of little companies that each create a part. And they meet in tea houses and on the internet to figure out how all this stuff will work together. There's no OEM. There's no Harley Davidson pulling all the strings. This is now the largest motorcycle industry in the world, and get ready for the $1,500 open source car coming from China as well. The final big theme is that peers within the boundaries of companies can now collaborate in ways that weren't possible. So 14,000 geeks at Geek Squad, who work for Best Buy, are now designing Geek Squad products. And IBM held a jam discussion over 3 days with 300,000 employees within IBM. So we call this the wiki workplace. How do you get going with wikis, blogs, social networks like the equivalent of Facebook within a corporation, collaborative filtering jams? These are beginning to revolutionize the way that we collaborate. So these are seven themes. Carlotta Perez, we're moving into decades to understand how this is going to change business models. Final thought. This, if I may use that term, is a paradigm shift. And when you get one of these, you get a crisis of leadership. Vested interests fight against change, and leaders of old paradigms are often the last to embrace the new. How will companies find leadership for this change? And given that this is not, the last 45 minutes, I've been talking about the corporation as an institution. The same thing applies for our other institutions like government. We can move to a government 2.0 and a new model of democracy. The same things apply to education and learning. Our educational institutions have pretty much been unchanged for centuries. An old model of pedagogy and an old model of what is a university or what is a school. The same thing could be applied to other institutions. How are we going to find the leadership to make this happen? Well, my experience, and I've worked with thousands of companies and governments and so on, you know where leadership comes from within these organizations for the ones that are able to do this? Big surprise. Leadership can come from anywhere. It can come from a head of state, rare, from a CEO, a chairman, a CIO, a business unit manager, an outside advisor. We documented a story of a secretary who was the key person in the transformation of a division of Citibank, and she had what it took to be a leader. She willed it, basically. Leadership is leadership for learning. There's a guy named Peter Senge, over 20 years ago, wrote a book called The Fifth Discipline. Boys, he turned out to be right. The person at the top can't learn for the organization as a whole anymore. Things are getting too complicated. And that leaves me with a very optimistic thought that because leadership can come from anywhere, and we're seeing it happening all over the place, that leadership is each of our own personal opportunity if we will it. And you've probably self-selected to be a leader anyway because you've come to this event. So I've got a few minutes for questions and comments. I'm sorry, I talked for quite a while. Any thoughts, and then we'll wrap it all up. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, right here. What comes after this? Well, if by this you mean changes to the structure of the corporation and how we orchestrate capability, there are people who might argue that will eventually, as collaboration costs drop to zero, that corporations will go away and we'll all be independent actors. I don't think that's going to happen in my lifetime. And again, we were talking about this in the previous session. I think one thing that might happen next regarding the corporation is a new age of participation where people can participate in the economy and in economic activity like they couldn't before. So you're a great teacher in California. You really know how to get through to kids on what is a cosine in grade 9 geometry. The California textbooks are going to be wikied, and you'll be able to write a textbook, not just to read one, or not just to hand one out to your kids. Al Gore has this thing called Current TV. You go onto the web, and it shows you how to create a great little 3-minute, 4-minute TV clip. You know, have good lighting and sense of presence, and have a good closing, and then you post that on the web. If people like it, it gets broadcast on the cable network. You can not only watch the news, you can create a news clip. You know, you love the Super Bowl, and one of the things you love is the ads. Well, you can now create a Super Bowl ad, like a bunch of nobodies did in the Doritos Super Bowl ad contest. And some of these ads are truly extraordinary, and these nobodies are now somebodies. You can fight, save lives in a crisis by participating on Google Maps in Katrina. You can fight... You can help find a cure for AIDS just by leaving your computer on at night and joining the global SETI or the equivalent network where all of these computers are being used to do massive computation. You're a poor kid in Mumbai. You've always wanted to go to MIT. MIT's opened up its courseware now on the web. You can go there and learn how to be a kick-ass computer programmer. And you won't get a degree, but if you're a good programmer, this is a meritocracy that's emerging, and you will be found. Maybe you'll go onto the top coder network that has 120,000 programmers for hire by individuals, and big companies are constantly putting stuff out onto top coder. I mean, you're a retired chemist in Orlando, and rather than driving a limo, as one I met, you can participate in the Innocentive network and find that next great molecule that P&G is looking for and make yourself a couple of $100,000. So... It's a very positive and hopeful sort of view. There's a whole dark side to this as well, of course. Yes, back here.
Using your P&G example, how do companies efficiently filter the potentially thousands and thousands of responses? So if 150,000 chemists respond to the red wine molecule question, is there an efficient way to get through that and make sense of it?
Yes, there are 6 million stories in the Naked City, and there's 6 million approaches to how these things actually work. And in the case of P&G and Innocentive, what you get is That's at one end of the model, where they put out a very detailed description of what they're looking for. And it becomes very clear very quickly. And they have people, not a lot of them, a dozen people, that are just looking at the stuff that comes in. It becomes very clear very quickly if this submission is in any way going to correspond. Now, if you take it to the other extreme, we were just discussing earlier, if you can have a discussion of 300,000 employees in a company, the way that works is with collaborative filtering, where the best ideas get rated. Now, you're trusting everybody to, you're trusting the mob, if you like, to decide what's a good idea and what isn't. But it turns out in the case of IBM, a whole bunch of really good stuff came to the fore. And when you think about new models of government and democracy, this can now be extended to an entire population. So you will see in countries, the first one will be Canada in January of next year, a three-day discussion. This one's called Canada Jam. And it will be a conversation amongst the population of Canada. And so now you have millions of people, not just a dozen chemists submitting stuff. You have millions. But it's basically collaborative filtering, where the good stuff finds a way to get to the fore. And this is the new web. And it's, I'm very thankful you asked the question, because it shows the difference with the old web. I worked with the White House right at the end of Clinton's term. And we were going to do a digital brainstorm. And the president was going to come on television Monday morning, and he was going to say, for the next week, we're going to have a discussion in America. And the topic I've chosen, which he had chosen, was the digital divide. Okay, how do you close this divide in America of haves and have-nots? And we're going to break it up by state, and we'll have a teachers group and a lawmakers group looking at tax credits, and a community group talking about community computing centers and so on. What we were going to do back then was get 10,000 university students to actually read all this stuff, and they would decide what came forward, sort of like the way it works for American Idol, that you have lower-level judges that do the initial screening, and progressively the judges get wiser. Well, now you don't have to do that, because we have collaborative filters and other techniques like that that can enable the good stuff to come to the fore. Yes?
Some of the biggest challenges we face are involve multiple disciplines. Say, a big one, climate change. You have urban sprawl, you have coal plants, you have transportation, you have some disciplines. Can you speak to particular approaches or issues relate to collaboration across?
Well, that's a heck of a good question, because around climate change, for example, you'll have scientists that'll all be working on some technical aspect of it, and the breakthrough may come from way over there, and that's happening in another community. Do you know, in the case of Goldcorp, they got submissions from chemists that were proposing organic solutions to these fundamentally inorganic problems. But again, this is Wickenomics. This is the art and science of harnessing mass collaboration. You need to architect your approach. Now, in the case of Canada Jam, what will happen is you're going to get all of that cross-fertilization, because there'll be, you know, a group maybe of architects who'll say, well, what if we retrofitted all of these buildings from the 20s to the 60s that have terrible insulation? We could probably get a 6-year payback, and blah, 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 blah. But those groups will be organically linked to all kinds of other discussions, so that anyone could go into that chemist group, into the architect group, and propose some completely off-the-wall situation. So it's all, the future doesn't just happen. You know, it's something to be achieved. And self-organization is wonderful, but still, there's a big role for leadership, for context providers, for people who architect the environment whereby these things can occur and achieve their potential. I'll take one more, and then I'll be upstairs with the books, and if you want to come individually, we can do that too. Yeah. Well, you get a paradigm shift, and every institution needs to change. I think our patent laws are probably outmoded. Although, to their credit, the patent department is now using mass collaboration. They used to have the experts would look at all this stuff, and now they're just putting this stuff out onto the web, so anyone can comment. We have laws that work in a whole bunch of areas that address many of the dark side issues. So we have laws about child porn, and we have laws about organized crime, and we have laws about terrorism, and we have laws about protecting privacy. You can't violate those laws. There's this gray area that was our previous session was about what happens to the governance of the internet itself, and this is a very complicated question. As the Art Kleiner, who introduced that session, said that we had some trouble with the panelists organizing the session because spam filters got a hold of some of our emails. And the irony was not lost on anyone in the audience. But I think, you know, you get changes in the economy, and these lead to changes in our institutions, our laws, our jurisprudence, our structures. And I can expect, or you can expect, that you will see over a period of time that there will be many other changes as well. I'll just leave you with a final thought, which I wanted to say in the earlier session, but I didn't get a chance to, is that the future is not something to be predicted. It's something to be achieved, and we need to get involved. You know, talk to your kids. Check out Facebook. Go onto Wikipedia and edit something. Personal use is the precondition for any kind of comprehension. And get engaged in a community and online or in your local community trying to do stuff, because this is how we're going to ensure that this new digital age is an age of promise fulfilled and peril unrequited. There was a French pilot from the Second World War. His name was Saint-Exupéry, and he says, we should welcome the future, for soon it will be the past, but we should respect the past, for it was once all that was humanly possible. And I don't mean to be too hard on our old institutions, because we did what was possible. But it's now possible to go forward. Another Frenchman, Victor Hugo, says, there's nothing so powerful as an idea whose time has come. The time has come for this new web. The time has come for a new generation for whom a new medium of communications is their birthright. And the time has come for some profound changes to our corporations, to the ways that we innovate, and to other institutions. And hopefully the time has, come for each of you to find that leader within you, maybe to change your organization and in doing so to change the world. For sure, the next period will not be boring, so thank you.